Future Commerce is brought to you by Vertex. Vertex is the leader of tax technology solutions and services for corporations worldwide. They're trusted by over half of the Fortune 500. Vertex Cloud meets sales and use tax solutions for businesses of all kinds. Visit them online today at vertexsmb.com. Future Commerce is brought to you by DotMailer. DotMailer is faster, smarter, and better email marketing automation. DotMailer is trusted by thousands of leading brands around the world. You can start your free trial today at dotmailer.com/futurecommerce and be sure to use the offer code FUTURECOMMERCE for 20% off applicable DotMailer packages.
Welcome to Future Commerce, the podcast about cutting edge and next generation commerce. I'm Brian.
I'm Philip.
And today with us, we have David Katz, CMO from Randa Accessories. Say hello.
Hello, everyone. I'm thrilled to be here. Philip and Brian, it's great to be on the podcast. I listen to you guys. And so I look forward to discussing all kinds of interesting topics today.
Thanks. Yeah, no, glad to have you.
Awesome. We're excited too. Yeah, go to kick things off. You know, tell us about yourself. What's your story? You know, tell us more about Randa. I don't know if all of our listeners are necessarily familiar with Randa, even though it's huge. And give us a little background.
Yeah, I mean, Randa, interestingly, is one of the largest companies that most of your audience has never heard of.
Right.
We're the world's largest men's accessories company. We also do some women's product and kids and some others, but we make belts and ties and wallets and scarves and hats and luggage and bags. And we do that under about 65 brands from Ralph Lauren and Dockers and Levi's to Tommy Hilfiger and Williams and Dickies and Ben Sherman and others. And we do that in quite a few global markets. We have 23 offices. We have 4,000 associates. As an example, we're the number one supplier of belts at Nordstrom, but also at Walmart and at Target and Costco and Marshalls and Macy's and Penney's. And we do the same thing, and Amazon.com, obviously, in today's world. And we do the same thing at El Corte Inglés in Spain and Printemps in France and Edgar's in South Africa and Meijer in Australia and Liverpool in Mexico and Hudson Bay, et cetera. So
one or two places.
So a couple of places, right. So again, you haven't heard of us, but one of the things that I make a pretty good wager on is that both of you and virtually every man listening to this podcast owns some of our product and uses it on a daily and weekly basis pretty frequently. In fact, most people own several of our products. We ship nearly 75 million units of product a year. So a lot of stuff out there. And so that gives us a very interesting perspective on kind of retail transformation, on brand strategy. It's kind of an interesting mix of how we go to market. So that's kind of big picture. How did I get into this? I took the most rational, logical path you can imagine. I started as a medical student studying neuroscience. And so you can see how that relates to making a better world through better belts. And, you know, I kind of started off in the physiology and psychology of human behavior and ended up, my family was in a number of businesses and offered me a bribe, which I accepted to take a 1-year deferment and not spend the next, you know, 9 years in school without having some break. And I never went back to med school. I eventually went to business school, but I got my hands dirty kind of operating businesses that had wholesale products, brands associated, selling them to retailers, and then kind of going through the transformation that's out there today. So that's a little bit about Randa and a little bit about me. And I don't know if that answers the kind of the setup there.
Yeah. Well, and you're also really prolific. Like you were just named a top LinkedIn voice for retail. You've been honored by Medium and for similar writing. And you know, we're really excited to have you on. I know that you've had a lot to say over the years. And where can people find you? Usually do this at the end, but where can people find you on the web? Where do you like to engage?
Well, certainly LinkedIn is a platform primarily for me as a business to business discussion, but I also speak to some consumers, to job seekers, et cetera. You can find me there. I do a decent amount of public speaking, so I speak mostly at trade events. So things like Shop Talk that's coming up and the Insights conferences that are held in Washington. I speak at some of our brand partners conferences and to retail summits and for Women's Wear Daily and occasionally the Wall Street Journal events, et cetera. So you can kind of catch me there, but mostly I have a day job. So my day job is selling products to consumers, most of that through our major retail partners. And I'm really fortunate that I get to deal with some of the best and brightest retailers and brand owners in the world. And they're happy to share their views with me. And I get to share some of my opinions with them. And that's what I kind of do for a living. So that's great. And certainly there's a change in that. I mean, I will tell you that when I first entered into this business and our market shares were, say, 10% of the belt business, and the goal was, gee, how do you become 15 or 20%? It's more penetration. How do you put more of our belts into a store? How do we put another brand there? We are now, for good news, bad news, we're dominant in our industry. So we're the majority of the market. And depending upon channel, we can be 90 or 100% of the market. Wow. The good news, bad news there is, when floor traffic and retailers starts to slide like it is, how do you grow your business? Because I can't exactly go to my CEO and say, oh, by the way, we won, I can go home now. The goal is to continue to grow. And that means stimulating customer response to buy more of our category. It's not share of market. I want increased spending in our classifications. I want a bigger share of the customer's wallet. And that takes me back to kind of my neuroscience of how do you stimulate customer behavior and go back to focusing on what drives their needs rather than simply looking at how do I improve business-to-business metrics. So it's kind of interesting watching how that transitions as our universe around us transitions.
It's interesting because I just had the same conversation with another retailer out in Seattle. We did a live podcast event at the Filson flagship store with Something Digital. We were talking Filson, who's like this historic outfitter, over 120 some odd years in business, and has a background in like supplying the outfitter and supplier for people going out to the Yukon back in the gold rush days. Very interesting story. Yeah, for the very first time in their business, they're getting into things like licensed technologies and fabrics. For the very first time, they're getting into categories like shorts and short sleeve shirts that they had never been in. And they feel like sort of combating the vertical challenge by going a little horizontal with the types of products that they offer is one way for them to grow. It sounds like, that's not, by no means is that, a new strategy. But for them, it's tough, right? Because it also causes them to have to think about who they are and who they want to be as a company. Do you think that for Randa, that you have similar sort of, persona or who do you want to be conversations, or have you just so dominated or thoroughly dominated certain categories that they lead on, like leather work happens to lead on to other things that are in similar spaces and tooling? Or give me some thoughts about that.
So I think that's a great question. And my answer is kind of bifurcated into both yes and no. The yes, we've got disruption that changes it. I mean, it used to be that I would lose sleep over competitive environment, large companies who are in the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that will enter or already compete in our space. And how are they going to take market share from us? And how are consumers going to perceive us? Today, I don't lose a lot of sleep, but when I do lose sleep, it's because there's a 17-year-old young lady who has a 3D printer in her garage. Mm-hmm. And she's going to invent something that is going to make much of the go-to-market strategies and barriers to entry and moat building that we've done over years irrelevant. I mean, as an example, we spent over $25 million making sure if you walk into any department store or large apparel retailer in North America and you go shopping for pants, because you probably didn't go in that store specifically to buy a belt or a wallet or a hat. So if you went in there to buy pants, we surrounded the pant pads, the areas of the store that have pants, with fixtures that hold coordinating belts in multiple brands, colors, and et cetera. And so you go in to buy a pant, we've surrounded that and we've spent all this money and we have an in-store merchandise coordinating division where people go into the stock rooms and they take inventory from the stock rooms and they put them onto fixtures. So every size, every color is in stock every single day in every brand. And so we, and all that resource, it would be very hard for a competitor to do that. We have 3,000 people who hit 10,000 stores a week doing that as W2 employees. And we have millions and millions of dollars of this inventory and fixtures that surrounds the pant. And if you're looking for a dress shirt, we have our ties right there, right? So we do all. Now, what happens when you're buying online or doing virtual social shopping?
Sure.
Is that all of that infrastructure and all of that CapEx we've spent is irrelevant. When you shop for Levi's pants online, you see another pair of denim bottoms. You don't see a Levi's belt that we make right next to it. And so it's disruptive to us, and people are coming up with models and you know, that really alter those core competencies. So A, we're secure in one way because we've got this great market share in the traditional model, but B, that model's being, you know, and I think, by the way, the word disruption is overused, and, you know, I can go back to school and that was Clay Christensen, and the idea of disruption was very specific. I think we're seeing transformation, and it's an ongoing, not a one time it just happened. You go back to American my grandmother came to America through Ellis Island. She shopped at a little local general store, a dry goods store, and the owner there knew her, knew her family, knew if there was a new child who needed milk and stocked it and talked to her. And then disruption happened when you got a department store in New York City.
Sure.
And then that got disrupted when you had regional stores and then catalog showrooms and catalogs. And then Sears opens in 1910 that 1,200-page behemoth catalog where from home you can see 1,000 products you didn't know existed. And if you order them by mail and you put your postage on it and you mailed it to them, a month or so later, a Wells Fargo wagon drawn by horse comes up to your house and delivers it. And that was disruptive, and that was the end of retail the way that we knew it, right? And so you look at this today, it's just, it's an ongoing process. I mean, I would say that these changes in technology happen faster than ever before, and there's more transparency than ever before, but it's an ongoing process. And you know, there are very few companies that can stand still, even if they're dominant in market share, and then sit back and go, I'm done. You know, leadership is not a destination. I wish it were.
If I could ask one more question, which I'll let Brian get back to what we had actually planned to talk about.
No, this is good. I've got follow up questions on this too.
Speaking of, I'm sorry.
This is great. This is good.
Yeah, I love being the disruptor on the panel. So my question to you then would be, and I don't want to put you on the spot. Tell me if I'm out of bounds, but you know, we are seeing technology and licensed technology like mission belts and like those latch belt type things in that space. Like what can you continue to improve and drive technology improvement to capture those types of new innovations in the market? Or is that something that's just like, is that another area of improvement for investment for a company like Randa? Or is that sort of a scrappy upstart kind of a play that is niche at best?
So I believe you're referring to product innovation in a kind of old world legacy product like a leather belt.
Correct.
And I think the answer to that is, you know, nothing is so perfect, so ideal that you cannot reinvent, reimagine, and innovate to make it better and more relevant. I think that whether it's sliced bread, and I mean that literally, or it's toothpaste, or it's footwear, or it's a belt, I think you can constantly improve and make it more valuable to the consumer. And I think the consumer's need, wants, and usage of these kinds of products changes over time. And so that you need to adapt to the changing market. So the answer is, I don't know that it's radical innovation, but for instance, the belts you're describing with ratchets instead of holes in them, that's a pretty different belt technology. There's no hole. There's little kind of indents in the back that click into place with a compression buckle. We introduced those a couple of years ago. It's now the single fastest growing belt concept that we have, and it does make a difference. And in athleisure wear and in stretch pants where you need adjustments that are finer than 1-inch holes, it actually adapts and works to people's more active lifestyle. And so that's relevant. We have a belt buckle that has a little battery, rechargeable battery you can use to charge your phone. I personally think that's a little gimmicky. I don't think that that's better than other things. But we did something interesting. When you talk about product innovation, men are a little slower than women. I know the audience here is mostly men, at least from the demographics I've seen. But so forgive me for saying this, but men are a little slower when it comes to adapting to fashion and apparel technology. But women have had stretch fabrics for quite a while in their athleisure wardrobes. They're much more comfortable, and I don't think they're ever going back to something that's uncomfortable, that doesn't stretch, that you know is just not as good a product. Men's product got into that more recently. We were slower to adapt. But now that we have it, if you have pants that stretch, but you have a belt that doesn't stretch, you have a problem. Mm-hmm. So we've created leathers and have worked with and mixed materials that literally can stretch as you need them to stretch and then contract when you don't need them to. So as you move in your stretch pants, your belt stretches with you. And
yes, please. That's amazing.
Yeah, right? So, I mean, this is an example of, you know, it wasn't that relevant before we had stretch pants, but now you need them. And by the way, Thanksgiving's a great time to wear those. So, you know, these are innovations that actually make our consumers' lives better. They also, if they're more satisfied, they pay a higher average unit retail, and we get to get a, you know, and when you have fewer customers shopping in stores, you better capture a larger percentage of them, and you better get an higher average unit retail for a good reason. And so I do believe you can continue to do that. We have wallets now that have what's called RFID screens in them. An RFID screen, you hear something your audience can be afraid of that they weren't afraid of before, but people can scan through your wallet with a radio frequency reader, a little device that are mostly used in retailers and in warehouses to identify product. They can scan your credit cards through your wallet from about 25 feet away. And they can take your ID through that. And so what we've done with our wallets is we now build a film. It's a very light metallic film that's inside the leather that is a screen, and you cannot screen through that. So no one can read your ID. And we've gone from 0% being RFID shielded, let's say 3 years ago. By fall of 2018, more than 90% of the wallets we sell in the world will have that screen built in. And so is that a major technology change? No, but it's due to changes in the marketplace. And so there's innovation in a category like that as well. So yeah, I do think you can nothing is so perfect that if you study the market carefully and you study your consumers, you can't make it better.
That's good. I want to hit on something else you talked about a couple minutes back about how, you know, you absolutely dominate, you know, traditional brick and mortar retail right now with an unbelievable strategy. That strategy was just mind blowing to me. You mentioned, you know, someone goes and searches for jeans, they're going to have other recommendations for other types of jeans come alongside them. Other similar sort of disruptive things are happening because of internet, you know, internet sales. What are you doing right now to combat some of that stuff? What are you investing in? What do you see as viable technology to help you do what you did with brick and mortar, but online?
Another great question. And I don't know that we're trying to stop that. What we're trying to do is adapt to that and use it. So yes, very much we're trying to take the same concept, which is if you shop for a Levi's 501 or 511 jean, 511 has stretch and it's a little slimmer, and there are reasons we invented zippers, by the way, instead of button down. So if you're looking for men's denim, or you're looking for Levi's specifically, we are using a variety of marketing technologies that are digital to make sure that during your shopping experience, and particularly once you get to the shopping cart, that we are showing you accessories that work with that particular item. And then as you leave that site and you've made your purchase, we will continue to haunt you and stalk you with coordinating items that go with the purchase that you made.
That makes
sense. So we're trying to, yeah, we're trying to kind of take that experience we did in mortar and brick and also be able to do it digitally. But the other thing that's important on this one is that although we all talk about e-commerce and online sales, the vast majority of a retail in general, but particularly apparel and accessories, and it's somewhere between 85 and 90% and sometimes more depending upon the classification, is sold in stores. The biggest shift is you're influenced by what you see online.
Right.
And whether that's social media or you're walking into a Walmart or a Nordstrom or a Macy's or a Kohl's or wherever you shop, when you or Old Navy or Gap or Banana Republic, when you walk in, your smartphone is in your hand and you're checking reviews and recommendations and curation and style guides and pricing. That transparency and ubiquity of information says we need to be online giving you information even if you're going to buy it when it's right in front of you in the store. And that's something we're also spending a lot of time on.
Now it's time for our weekly segment called Future Policy, brought to you by Vertex SMB. As always, we're joined by Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Danny Sepulveda.
So this is actually a really interesting case before the Supreme Court that the court is expected to adjudicate by the end of June. And the question is whether or not the Department of Justice can compel Microsoft to disclose information that it holds on a server in Ireland. The Department of Justice has gone through all the proper procedures in the United States to get a warrant and to go to Microsoft and say, you know, we have a warrant for information on someone we suspect of a crime. Microsoft has said, well, look, that information resides in Ireland. If you want that information, you have to ask the Irish government to allow us to provide that information because we have to comply with Irish law. To which the Department of Justice says, no, that's not true. You don't actually have to go to Ireland to get the information. You can disclose it from here by pulling it back out of the cloud. The scenario here is a very bad one because no matter what the outcome, it has really challenging implications for the operation of the cloud internationally and for the architecture of the internet. Let's say, for example, that Microsoft wins the case and the Department of Justice cannot acquire information that it has legal authority to acquire because the information is held outside of the United States. Now, it could be anything, right? I mean, we don't know, in the worst case scenario, a terrorist, or in a much less bad case scenario, some less serious form of crime. There is no question as to whether or not, if that information were held in the United States, whether it would have to be turned over to the DOJ. So let's say the Microsoft wins. That would create a competitive incentive for folks to sell services to clients on the grounds that they will store it overseas and therefore that information will not be accessible to American law enforcement. From a public safety perspective, from an international security perspective, that would be a bad outcome. Let's say the Department of Justice wins. Any private actor in the United States with a physical presence who is accessible to the Department of Justice would then be subject to having any information they hold anywhere in the world subject to access by the Department of Justice. So that takes away your security concerns, but it adds new concerns. And the most concerning of the new concerns for me would be that the world would react to that. India would say, well, if the American government can reach into Ireland and pull evidence, why can't the Indian government reach into the United States and pull evidence for crimes committed in India? The answer will be because we don't let you. That would encourage data localization laws around the world. And India would just say, okay, fine. Then we'll force any communications with Indians to be stored in India or some copy of that to be stored in India. And that breaks the economics of cloud and the utility of data. And there's a whole lot of reasons why that's a bad idea. So given that both outcomes are poor, there's a group of senators that have introduced a new piece of legislation called the Clarifying Overseas Use of Data Act, which says it would eliminate the court suit. It would accept the DOJ argument that the United States, having gone through a proper procedure in the courts, the United States government can access information held by any American cloud service anywhere in the world, or any company that has a physical presence in the United States and is subject to American law, to their information held anywhere in the world. It would ameliorate the countering problem by saying the government would be allowed to engage in new executive agreements between the executive of the United States and the executive of another country that would allow either party, either the United States, let's take India, for example, and India to say, okay, we don't have to go through the government anymore. As long as we've gone through our own jurisdictional legal proceedings, that we can ask a company, or not compel, but ask a company, and the company will be allowed to comply with that request to bring information from abroad into the given jurisdiction where that information is held. What's interesting is that the Silicon Valley companies, the cloud providers, that's the private sector tech community has really kind of rallied around this solution. And our friends in Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Center for Democracy and Technology, a number of privacy experts raised very serious concerns about it. And their concerns are the Cloud Act and these executive agreements would not put into place sufficiently strong standards by which a foreign government could access someone's information. This is a really, really interesting debate over the power of American markets and the power of American government to compel changes in law and behavior around the world by the fact of the power of our market. The amount of information that travels or is stored in the United States as a function of how cloud is managed is so large that many countries around the world at this point have real enforcement challenges because they lack access to evidence for everything from child abuse to terrorism. Where we're headed is a real debate over the degree to which we can compel changes in law abroad in exchange for allowing governments abroad to access people's information here and thereby preserve the cloud as an international instrument, or whether the only alternative from a law enforcement perspective that those countries will have is really a data localization alternative. It's one to watch. It's one that I think I'm going to keep updating you guys on as time proceeds, and one that I really encourage you all to look into the debate and see how you feel about the question and where you might want to weigh in with your legislators.
Future Commerce is brought to you by Vertex. Vertex provides cloud and on-premise solutions that can be tailored to specific industries for every major line of tax, including sales and use, income, value added, and payroll. Vertex Cloud is the SaaS solution that automates sales and use tax, including calculation and returns. With multiple service levels and flexible pricing models, Vertex Cloud meets the sales and use tax needs for businesses of all sizes. From recognizable brands like Honda, Pepsi, Verizon, and small businesses the world over. Find out more today at vertexsmb.com and be sure to mention Future Commerce Podcast to get 15 months for the price of 12. Once again, that's vertexsmb.com. Future Commerce is brought to you by DotMailer. DotMailer is used by thousands of marketers around the world. It has quick and easy campaign creation with a world-class intuitive interface. The DotMailer team is always on hand from email creation, creative, and delivery to dedicated consultancy helping you build your own success story. DotMailer is built to play well with others. You can build your own marketing cloud by extending DotMailer or integrating it with your existing e-commerce and business platforms. Become a smarter, faster, better marketer and create sophisticated and measurable campaigns with DotMailer. Go to dotmailer.com/futurecommerce to start your free trial today and be sure to use the offer code FUTURECOMMERCE for 20% off DotMailer packages. Thanks again to DotMailer for supporting Future Commerce.
So let me take this in a little bit of a different direction now. You know, Randa, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, isn't necessarily a brand that everyone knows. It's sort of the brand behind a lot of brands. Richard Kestenbaum, who was on the show earlier, probably about 6 months ago or something like that, he just came out with an article called Ingredient Brands and how important they were and so on. I wouldn't necessarily classify Randa as an ingredient brand, although there may be technologies that you have that are sort of are part of that, and I'll let you speak to that. But Just brand as a concept is really like beginning to shift these days. It's easier to go direct to consumer. And you know, there are other reasons why brands are shifting. We see brands like Brandless come about, and really kind of change up the idea of what a brand is. How do you see brands evolving and, you know, the idea of an ingredient brand, you know, is that something that Randa is a part of, and what is that part of your strategy going forward?
Well, thank you for asking six questions embedded in one.
That's our spiritual gifts. Yeah.
Exactly. Thanks a lot. Yeah. And I'll try to address the bucket of those. First, we, you know, I think Richard is, he was a terrific guest on your show. B, I love reading his stuff in Forbes and online. I think his concept about ingredient brands is fascinating. I believe what he was talking about with that was the Intel Inside concept and Gore-Tex and DuPont, Cordura, and the things that are elevation that are not necessarily the branded product, but the things inside the product that makes it more valuable. And yes, we do have, we've invented a few technologies and have a few patents on what we call exact fit technology, which is one of the things that a belt does to adjust to your size. And we have that in other product categories. And we do put that inside other brands of products, and so we have some of that. But I think the bigger, broader question you're asking is what's the meaning of brands today, and how is that transforming and morphing in this new retail and compressed supply chain environment? And I think that's a really interesting question. You know, the word brand itself was originally that big hot iron with your logo on it that you shoved on the side of livestock and you branded them. And in a way, you know, we still identify ourselves and associate with our herd or our tribe, right? If you want to call it a tribe of similarly branded others. And I think brands still have a connection and a connotation and a curation and expectations that are associated with them that give you membership and validation. Now, with that said, it used to be that you associated yourself with a brand like Ralph Lauren or Calvin Klein or Lululemon. And by buying that particular brand, you were A, assured of a certain lifestyle coordination and matching that it fit your lifestyle. B, a certain quality value formula. I'm going to pay a certain price and it has a certain value because of that brand. And the third was, others who look at me are going to identify me because of the brand that I wear. And by choosing this brand, I fit into this herd or tribe. Now, that was the way marketing was before, because you only knew a few dozen or 100 some odd people that you dealt with on a regular basis. And you couldn't ask every single one of them, is this me? Is this good? Did you ever buy this product? What do you think of it? Do you think this would look good on me? Do you think this is my lifestyle? But today, with social media and online information and shopping, you can go on and see on Instagram or Facebook or Amazon.com or Bonobos or wherever you're going to look, you can see thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of people of what they think of a product. And they can tell you the product review and what they think of the quality and what they think was the price fair or was it less expensive at TJ Maxx. They can tell you whether or not this looks right for your particular kind of haberdashery lifestyle where you are a fashionista, or if it really fits somebody who's a Silicon Valley coder and it has to be Silicon Valley cool. They can tell you that, and you can get that information from the palm of your hand or by asking a virtual assistant without brand validation through traditional branding. So if it didn't say Ralph Lauren or Lululemon or Diane von Furstenberg, but these social connections that you've now made, these new online friends and mentors that you have, if they say it's valuable and it looks great and coordinated, is that enough branding for you?
Right.
And so I think what we're going to find is that there are going to be a very small number of powerful national and global brands that still mean something valuable, but we're going to have hundreds and thousands of digitally native brands and very focused brands that are going for a niche of customers, for, young Latino moms who live in Southern California, there's going to be a brand that you may not have heard of, but it's incredibly relevant to them because they can find those people online instantly. And there's going to be something for people who took CS5, you know, computer science at Harvard, and they all have their modern version of pocket protectors. And there's going to be a brand for that, that they love, that everyone, you know, and so you're going to find brands in that kind of context. And then you're going to find things that are just highly reviewed, great values, and they don't necessarily have a recognizable brand at all. And so I do think we're seeing a transformation of how people look at what brands are supposed to do and how they value them. I don't know if that answered the kind of bucket of questions, but.
Oh, yeah, it did. Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was thinking. You know, I think, you know, we're in agreement. I love that the talk about hyper-personalized brands. I think, you know, in, you know, especially, you know, we look at generic branding from Amazon and, you know, we see a lot of these like smaller niche brands pop up on that are advertising on Facebook and, you know, I think everyone that's listening to the show can probably agree they've been flooded by brands recently that they've never heard of or experienced. And, you know, I think we're still probably a little bit early on in how well we've been able to market those brands and like actually address the markets that we want to address with them, because I get hit with ads for things all the time that I'm not interested in any way, shape, or form. But I think the future of where, you know, where we're headed here with us is exactly what you've said: hyper-personalized, hyper-focused, just an absolute swath of brands for every little segment. And it might even get Nick Vu from Adidas said that they were getting as targeted at Adidas as a specific city block.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I think geographic area, you know, that's certainly one factor, but, you know, we're going to be able to get even, you know, more targeted. Like people might even target specific Reddit groups or specific, you know,
sure,
you know, really,
yeah, I think that like those associations can be, yeah, and micro community is perfect, right? It can be geographic, it can be particularly on Facebook, it can be interests, it can be others within your hobbies that you have and or your political associations, good or bad. You know, I think that we can now target people's interests and unique their needs, because their needs are very different and they have multiple needs at different points in their life and during their day. And they may be, you know, they may be very dressed up and buttoned up and formal when they're at work, but very casual and into sports when it's a Saturday and football's going on. And they might be something very different when they're out at a garden party with their friends. And so to be able to target them in their different and varying interests and the experiences that are valuable to them is going to change the way we look at branding. I think people don't want to be one of a million. They want to be one in a million. And I think what technology does is it lets us identify that distinct uniqueness. And, you know, if I go back to my grandmother, right, I mentioned that, you know, she comes over Ellis Island and there's this general store, and the proprietor of that store knew what the family needed and knew what you needed. I think data mining and big data analysis, when it's used properly, brings us backwards 100 years to where the proprietor, which is the owner of the data and the aggregator of this information, knows those changes and knows you well and provides you with what you need in a timely fashion on the method of delivery and the credit card or payment method of your choice, which is how that proprietor would do if you needed a little, hey, I'll deliver it and I'll put it on your tab.
Yeah, I think also we're able to collect new types of data too. New data points are happening all the time based off of, you know, personal tech and other things that are coming about. One of those, and we talked about this a ton on the show, is data related to your body. You know, and obviously you're in the accessories business. Have you had any experience using body data to help craft better products or address your customers' needs in a deeper way?
In In a limited way, most of our products do not have the variety of body metrics that are required that apparel needs. So right. In the belt business, we need to know your waist size, and that's data that's very valuable to us, and it varies geographically by age, by channel of distribution, and we look at that data constantly to make sure we have the right assortment sizes and inventory, right? And that's powerful. But for the most part, true body sizing and data points are more valuable in fitted apparel than they are in most of ours. What we do find is that data is telling us that, and we use some new technologies similar to that kind of data mining for VR and AR, for virtual reality and augmented reality, to say, if you're wearing this outfit and you take a selfie of yourself, we can augment and drop a tie or a pocket square or a hat or a belt onto what you're wearing to show you what that will look like based on machine learning. We're just starting to use AI on this, but it's mostly machine learning that says, based on what we identified from that image.
Wow.
Based on data we have, this is the, because remember, when you're our market share, I'm kind of agnostic to what belt you buy, what brand it is, what store you bought it at. I just want you to buy more belts.
Right.
So, right. And the problem is we make many thousands of styles of belts. So how do I recommend to you exactly the belt you need based on what you're wearing? And we're starting to use AR to do that. We look at you and then we can superimpose a belt that's going to coordinate or match what you're wearing. And that's kind of another form of data mining. It's not really the body metrics you're talking about for us, other than I mean, yes, we have other sized products, but for the most part, that's not a critical data point for us.
Wow, that's unbelievable. Is that something that's actively available for consumers to use right now?
We're in beta on it now, and hopefully the next time, if I don't totally screw up and you guys invite me back on the show, I'll be able to share more the next time we do this.
I assure you that nobody could screw this show up more than we can. So,
Well, I may give it my best shot. We'll see.
I did ask you like 6 questions in 1 question, so you know.
I'm kind of interested in sort of where you see technology leading us, which is, I know we're sort of skipping around here, but you know, looking out into the future 4 or 5 years, are you bullish on technology sort of leading the way into, you know, new areas of customer engagement? Or do you see us sort of, do you see people sort of over investing in technology as we see it today?
Again, I think that's a wonderful question and a complicated answer. Mm. I think that we have a double-edged sword here. I think it's very easy to get distracted by bright, shiny objects. And, you know, I speak every once in a while recently about that mall robot that was this wonderful security robot that could identify pickpockets and, you know, spills on the floor. And there it is running around a mall in Washington, and it takes a nosedive into a decorative fountain. And on Twitter, there was some great social comments about, hey, we feel your stress, robot, you know, but we, you know, there's still reason to live. And, you know, here's a shiny object somebody thought was going to be valuable, and it was just a shiny object. And I like what Brian Cornell, who's the CEO of Target, said. And you know, he looked at the store of the future, and his comment was, just because we can build something doesn't mean we should build something. And instead, he said, let's build more stores with smaller footprints that are closer to customers, that are easier to shop. Let's get to that. You know, Peter Drucker once has this great quote that I use, which is, there's nothing so useless as doing incredibly efficiently something you didn't need to do at all. Mm. So, you know, I think when technology provides a better experience for the customer and for your associates and peers, then it adds incredible value. And if it doesn't do that, then I think it can distract your human and capital resources in a direction that is just, it's fun to talk about on the golf course, but it doesn't move the needle for your consumer. And I think if you look at Amazon, they're a great example of, they have lots of interesting technology. They have more patents in the fashion retail business, I think, than anyone else. But they're very focused on, you know, let's put our technology in places where it values consumers the most. Let's make it faster, easier, more convenient, and not just cool.
Hmm.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think Amazon's a really good example of applying technology in ways that's not just for the sake of technology, but in ways that consumers can actually leverage. Obviously, that you know, there's the that's what everyone's saying right now. But I think your point stands. You know, and it's really, really, it's been echoed on this show a couple of times. Sucharita Malpuru, was another strong advocate for exactly what you're saying. And this is really good for our merchant listeners. Don't just go build something because it looks cool, because it's you know, even if it's something that, you know, might be really enjoyable, if it's not helping your customers accomplish something that they really need, then it very well may not have the ROI that you're looking to achieve on it. Now, that said, you know, I think a lot of companies, KPMG and others, have been looking at retail in 2018 and calling it sort of the year of entertainment. What do you think about sort of the role of entertainment in retail experiences, and do they contribute to the bottom line? Does entertainment have a place in retail in the next couple of years?
Wow. Yeah, I didn't see that one coming. I think that you've got to be careful when it comes to entertainment, right? So what you're really balancing here is customer acquisition, stickiness and time they spend with you versus conversion to retail, return on investment, and lifetime value of that customer, right? So you're trying to figure out if you're more entertaining and you give them something they'll spend time on, will they ultimately enjoy your brand and find delight in it and therefore spend more time with you and shop with you and buy your products more often? And I think that it can. I think that if you look at what Starbucks does, I don't know if I'd call it entertainment, but you know, you spend, you know, I don't know, hopefully a minute getting your coffee, and then you spend an hour sitting there and on your laptop and kind of spending time in their experience. Mm-hmm. They just pulled, I mean, I think that one of the things that Howard Schultz did that was brilliant was he pulled a lot of the products they used to sell off their website.
Yeah.
You can't buy them online because that's not the experience of Starbucks.
Right.
The experience is smelling the coffee and being with the people and having a barista make your coffee and then opening your laptop and sitting at a table. And you can't, and therefore it dilutes the, and I don't know if I call this entertainment, but it dilutes your experience to do it online. So let's not give them it that way. And I think that took a lot of courage, and I think that's going to work. I think every once in a while having, you know, if you look at Abercrombie, simply spraying more fragrance and having scantily plaid young men to draw young women shoppers into the store for entertainment didn't prove to be an experience where they were going to buy more of the product. Mm. And so I think you've got to be careful of, are you entertaining for the sake of just entertaining? And by the way, once your entertainment gets boring or not relevant, they go somewhere else to be entertained.
Right.
Or is it really brand building? I mean, I used to spend time on QVC and HSN. And quite accidentally, and I mean this, we used to have a professional show host we hired who would go on air to do our products. And then one day they got caught in traffic and somebody goes, who's going to host your show? And I go, I guess we'll have to postpone. And they go, the show must go on. And they shoved like an IFB in my ear, put makeup on my face and threw me on stage. And
awesome.
which by the way, you know, then they needed a hook to pull me off stage. So that was another problem I created. But when you're on there, you have these digital monitors that face you, that show you incoming call volume, the number of people who are clicking through the site, looking at your product, the number of conversions while you're talking. And when you're doing $10,000 a minute, you actually have enough data that you can look at this. And so what you start to find is when I was telling an entertaining story, and if you want something really goofy, at one point I dressed up like a doctor because when I was pre-med student, I had like a lab jacket and a stethoscope. So I put that stuff on and I was selling a luggage product at the time. And I had our engineering department saw the luggage in half and then stitch it together loosely. And I put it under a white sheet and I rolled it out onto set on QVC on a gurney. And as the doctor, I said, let me show you the anatomy of a healthy suitcase. And I pull off the sheet and I use a scalpel on air to open up the suitcase and cut it apart and show you the how it's built and the lining and the frame and this really entertaining. So what ended up happening was viewership started going up. We had more people watching and no one was ordering. Because what happened was it was a great story. It was storytelling. It was entertaining. It's funny, but it doesn't encourage purchase. And so this balance between entertaining and stickiness and somebody watching you juggle versus let me show you why juggling is relevant to your lifestyle and why if you work with us, you'll be able to juggle better and these balls are easier to hold. And therefore, your experience of being at dinner parties is going to be more engaging to the people there. That's one thing. Just doing it for fun, you know, there's this balance of you're entertaining, but you're not selling. And you're not building a brand experience that you can carry forward. So I think when done correctly, I think the Starbucks experience can do that. I think what Apple does at their retail stores is brilliant with the Genius Bar and interacting with the product and having all these young people who love the brand talk to you about the brand and how easy it is to shop for. I think that's great. I think when Levi's builds a denim bar and a tailor shop into their stores that will customize your pants for you, and it's all about living in your Levi's and the heritage and personalizing them, that makes sense. When a denim bar similar to that was put into JCPenney, it just was a holding space that didn't generate extra traffic or extra dollars. Now, there are other things pennies could do. But, you know, but putting a coffee shop into your store or putting a barber salon or a haircut into your store, whether you're Toys R Us doing it for kids or something, may not really engage your customers in a way that's going to help your brand and increase conversion over time.
Wow, that's a great answer. I love that. I think it fits exactly what I think Philip preaches exactly what you're talking about all the time. If it's not engaging people and it's making their brands, your brand, them understand why your products actually are valuable for them, then why are you doing it? Like, you can't just be an entertainer.
Yeah. The famous quote from Ian Malcolm, Dr. Ian Malcolm on Jurassic Park, where he's like, your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should. And
that's your Jeff Goldblum impression?
It was a terrible Jeff Goldblum. Definitely verging on Captain Kirk, but we'll forgive it for a Friday afternoon. Awesome. Well, gosh, that was it was amazing. Great to have you on the show. Thank you so much. I'd love to have you come back, David, at some point.
Absolutely.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun being on your show. As I said, I'm a good listener and an avid listener to your show. And I thank you for inviting me. And I look forward to coming back. And you know, I look forward to hearing what your audience thinks of the discussion that we had today. But also, in general, I think these topics are relevant to a broad range of industries. And they're incredibly timely. So again, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Well, thanks for listening to Future Commerce. As always, would love to have a 5-star review from you on iTunes. So hop on there and please subscribe to listen. Also, if you want to, you know, just listen to the most recent episode, you can always say, hey, Alexa, play Future Commerce Podcast, or whatever digital assistant that you have in your home. We love
Spotify. Yeah,
Spotify. We're on Spotify now. Yeah, ask Google to play you on Spotify or whoever. So we love having you listen to the show. Retail tech is moving fast.
And Future Commerce is moving faster. Thank you. Thank you, David.
Thanks, David.
My pleasure.